then four, then three. When they were only a few feet away, Tard reached out cat-quick, one rough, gnarled hand wrapping around each mouth. He pulled them into his dark little fort. Chapter 6. The Rapscan Machine.
Pookie, wake up!
Robin pushed at Pookie's shoulder. He was on her couch and might as well have been dead for all he moved. She poked him again.
Come on, sleepyhead, rise and shine.
5 more minutes, Mom, he said. I promise all my chores are done.
You told me to wake you when the tests were almost finished.
That got his attention. Pookie pushed himself to a sitting position. He rubbed his face.
That coffee I smell.
Of course, Robin said. Go to the table, I'll get you a cup.
For the second night, or morning, depending on how you looked at it, her apartment had become their war room. Brian was already sitting at the dining room table, his hands around a mug, his eyes staring off into space. John's chair was empty. He was at the hospital. Robin had turned her dining room into an impromptu sample prep area. The Rapscan machine sat in the center of the table, processing the 2 samples Brian and Pookie had brought a few hours earlier. She'd loaded the cartridges and set the karyotype test to running. Any moment now, and it would finish. She walked to the kitchen and came back with a coffee carafe and a mug for Pookie. She filled his mug and refilled Brian's. Both men looked absolutely exhausted. Pookie had given her the sample materials, then headed straight for her couch. Brian hadn't said a word since he'd arrived. He just sat in his chair, first drinking a beer, then a scotch, then moving on to caffeine. Robin thought it best just to leave him be, let him work through whatever it was that was on his mind. If he wanted her help, he could ask her. She was done trying.
Sounds like you boys had quite the adventure, Robin said. I'm just glad no one got hurt. Other than Erickson, I mean.
Pookie nodded and took a sip of coffee.
Yes, no one got hurt. Permanently, anyway. How much longer until that test is done?
She looked at the machine's touchscreen.
About 5 minutes, maybe less.
Are you guys going to tell me who the second sample is from?
She knew the first sample was from Erickson, but they had avoided her questions about the second.
A perp from Erickson's house, Pookie said. We didn't catch him.
Once again, there was clearly more to the story than Pookie wanted to let on. Not surprising that he did the talking. He was a far better liar than Brian. Brian's head came up. He blinked rapidly, as if he'd been catnapping and was just becoming aware of his surroundings.
The ear, he said.
What?
Pookie nodded.
I forgot about that.
Me too,
Brian said. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a plastic evidence bag, and held it up for Robin to see.
Brian, she said, why do you have a human ear in a baggie?
It's from a stuffed person we found in Erickson's basement. Can you run DNA on it?
She reached out and took the bag, looked at the contents. The skin looked dry and brittle, almost like leather.
When you say stuffed, you mean like a big game animal? Stuffed for display?
Yeah. Can you test it for the Z chromosome?
Not here, she said. The tanning process destroys most of the cellular DNA. I'd need a biology lab, something with the equipment needed to try and extract any remaining DNA, and a PCR machine to amplify it. A university lab would work. Maybe SFSU, or I could try the hospitals. But that's going to take a few days, and I wouldn't hold your breath that it'll work.
Brian just looked at her. His eyes burned with both anger and anguish. He was a cauldron of emotions, so much so that Robin couldn't really remember the old Brian, the one with the cold, unfeeling stare. The machine beeped. Robin looked at the little screen. Erickson sample complete. She pressed the icon and read the results.
ZX, she said. Wow, Erickson is a Z.
Pookie and Brian didn't look surprised in the least.
Related? Brian said. Is Erickson related to the others?
Robin tapped the touch screen, scrolling through to the familial indicators. There it was, a match.
Bingo, she said. Jebediah Erickson, Rex Dipravdichuk, Blackbeard and Oscar Woody's killer all have the same mother.
Brian seemed to shrink into himself. He leaned back in his chair. His chin dropped to his chest.
Pookie shook his head. Wait a minute. We think Marie's children are these Zeds. If so, Erickson isn't just killing his own kind. He's killing his direct family? What is that all about?
Robin shrugged.
If Erickson is in custody, can't you ask him?
Might not be talkative, Pookie said. You know, considering he's in the ICU after taking a knife to the belly.
Brian looked up.
He's a Zed. He'll heal fast. We can go to the hospital and question Erickson directly. We just have to get around Zhao.
Pookie thought this over, then sipped at his mug.
Robin, you're a doctor. Can you find out Erickson's condition without anyone knowing that we're asking?
She hadn't been part of the hospital system for years, but many of her friends still worked there.
I probably can't get detailed patient info, but I can find someone to tell me if he's out of ICU.
The RAP scan beeped. Sample 2 complete.
Here we go,
she said. She clicked the icon and the results flashed up. She saw the marker for an X, then a Z, and also a Y.
This one is trisomal. It's XYZ, just like Rex. In fact,
she thumbed through the screens, looking for the familial indicator.
Yes, once again the same mother. All these guys are one big happy family.
Pookie's eyes widened. Brian's eyes burned with intensity, maybe even rage.
The same mother. You're absolutely sure.
Robin nodded. He stood and held out his right hand to Pookie, palm up.
Keys, he said.
Pookie looked worried.
Going somewhere, Bri-Bri?
Keys.
Maybe I should drive you, Pookie said. We could...
Give me the fucking keys.
Pookie leaned away. Robin held her breath. She'd never heard Brian raise his voice before. Not ever. Not even during their worst fights. Pookie dug his hand into his pocket and handed Brian his car keys. Brian took them and walked out of the dining room. Emma followed, tail wagging. The apartment door opened and shut. Emma came wandering slowly back into the dining room, looking for someone else to pay attention to her. Why had Brian stormed out like that?
Pookie, what the hell just happened?
Pookie leaned forward, rested his head in his hands.
I think Brian needs to go see his dad. Fuck this, I'm going back to sleep.
He stood up and pulled out his phone. He walked into the living room, his fingers texting out a message as he went. Without breaking stride, he finished the text, put the phone back in his pocket, then collapsed onto the couch, his back facing out into the living room. Emma shot in like a black and white streak, jumped up after him, and settled into the crook of his legs. Robin stared at Pookie. He was wiped out. Something big was happening between him and Brian, and she didn't know what it was. Why wouldn't they trust her? She wasn't tired, not at all. She found her phone and started scrolling through her contacts, looking for people that still worked at SFGH. Chapter 7. Aggie Gets a Roommate. Aggie James didn't want to wake up, but a part of his mind pulled at him, tried to drag him out of a dream where a little girl's lips pecked feather light on his cheek and her arms wrapped around his neck. He didn't want to wake, but wake he did. He sniffed. He rubbed at his face. The real bitch about getting sober? You start to remember things. Aggie James hadn't always been a strung-out homeless bum. Once upon a time, in fact, he'd owned a little counterculture internet cafe. He'd attracted a certain anti-establishment clientele. All kinds of people wandered in. But after seeing the giant Fuck Starbucks mural painted on the wall behind the coffee counter, the visitors either smiled and stayed, or frowned and left. He'd run the place with his wife and teenage daughter, right up until the robbery. The robber shot Aggie first. Shot him twice, in fact. Once in the leg, and once in the chest. He remembered dropping to his ass, back propped up by the counter. His blood ran everywhere. He couldn't move, couldn't lift a finger, but he stayed conscious long enough to see them put a bullet in his wife's head. He stayed conscious long enough to see his daughter run for the door, to see her shot in the back before she could reach it. He stayed conscious long enough to see her crawling across the floor, bloody hands reaching for him, begging for her daddy to help her. To please help her, please. Aggie James even stayed conscious long enough to see the gun pointed at his daughter's face, and just long enough to hear her last scream stop abruptly when the gunman pulled the trigger. Only then had he passed out. The cops told him the robbers probably thought he was dead, and that passing out had probably saved his life. His life. What a joke. Fucking memories. He couldn't shake them. Not until he'd done heroin for about a month straight. That made you forget everything. Almost. He'd lost all that mattered to him. Nothing would fill that inescapable dullness in his heart. Not that he'd tried very hard to fill it, of course. With no reason to go on, and not enough guts to kill himself, he'd chosen a slow route to the grave. A painful route. It's what he had coming, after all. If a man can't protect his family, does he deserve to live? Aggie had thought not. That was before the White Dungeon. This horrific place reminded Aggie that life, no matter how crappy it might be, was far better than the alternative. A day and a half ago, as near as he could tell, Hillary had given him hope. If there was even a chance to get out of this, to live, Aggie would do anything she asked. He finally blinked away the sleep to see that a new man had been chained to the wall on his left, where the Mexican woman had once been. Not a man. A boy, really. But a goddamn big boy. The kid's face looked like swollen hamburger. Split lip, broken teeth, blood all over his mouth, and a seriously fucked up nose. He was spitting up blood and making low moaning noises. Noises that had the cadence of speech, but were not words. The boy opened his mouth to moan louder, and Aggie saw why the sounds had no meaning. Someone had cut out his tongue. To his right, Aggie heard other noises he didn't understand, but that was only because he didn't speak Chinese. The Chinaman was on his knees, tear-streaked eyes shut tight, body rocking back and forth as he prayed to someone or something. Aggie James couldn't help the Chinaman, and he couldn't help the tongueless boy. He could only help himself, and only if Hillary gave him a chance. He lay back down and closed his eyes. Maybe he would dream of his daughter again. Chapter 8. Fathers and Sons. Brian pulled up to Mike Clouser's house to find his dad sitting on the front steps, Bud Light in hand. Five more bottles sat in a sixer at his feet. He was shirtless, wearing beat-up jeans and black socks with no shoes. He was waiting. That meant Pookie had called ahead. Fucking Pookie. Brian shut off the Buick's engine. His hand squeezed the steering wheel. If Erickson was 60 years old or more, and he was Brian's half-brother, then Brian's real mother would have to be 75 or probably even older. Mike Clouser and Starla Hutchton had gone to high school together. Brian had seen their yearbooks, their class pictures, other pictures of them from their childhoods and their grade school days. They had been born the same year. Mike had turned 58 a few months back. Mike, who the genetic test said was not Brian's father. And Starla, who was younger than Jebediah Erickson, which meant that the woman Brian had always known as his mother was anything but. All his life, Brian had been lied to. He felt that rage swelling up, the same rage he'd felt when Zhao had threatened him with jail. He stepped out of the Buick. Mike stood and reached for the front door, to open it, as if to invite Brian in. "Don't bother," Brian said. His father stopped and turned.
Pookie texted that you had something important to talk about.
Come in, we'll talk.
I don't want to go inside, Brian said. What I want to know is who my real parents are.
Mike Clouser stared for a moment. He slowly lowered himself to the front step and sat. He stared at the ground.
You're my son. Bullshit!
Mike looked up. His expression caught between the anger that solved most of his problems and a gut-wrenching pain from hurting his boy.
I don't care about biology. I wiped your ass and changed your diapers. I cleaned up your puke. When you got a fever, I felt like someone was chopping up my heart with a goddamn cleaver. You just cough, and the sound scared me worse than any fight I've ever been in.
To think Brian had loved this man, this liar.
Are you finished?
I took you to school, Mike said.
I hauled you to soccer practice. I watched every wrestling match you ever had, and when someone put you on your back, I had to grab the damn bleachers because it was all I could do not to come out on the mat and kick the other kid in the head. I'm the one who taught you right from wrong.
Quite a show of concern. But then again, Mike had a lifetime of practice. Brian's lifetime.
And in all those years, it never crossed your mind to tell me the goddamn truth. The truth is that you are my boy.
Mike's lower lip quivered, just for a moment. Then he seemed to force his emotions under control.
You will always be my son.
Brian shook his head slowly.
I'm not. I'm just a kid that you lied to.
Mike pulled an unopened bottle out of the Bud Light sixer. He held it between his palms, slowly rolling it back and forth.
I don't know how you found out, but you can forget the guilt trips because I wouldn't change a thing.
What had Brian been hoping for? Maybe a little remorse? Maybe a, gosh, I'm so sorry? Mike wasn't apologizing. At least his character was consistent in that regard.
Who are my parents? You owe me that, so start talking.
Mike set the bottle on the step next to his feet. He looked weak. The expression on his face, the sagging posture. Brian had seen those things only once before, when his mother had died.
There was a homeless guy in our neighborhood, Mike said. Eric. Never knew his last name. He was a combat vet, Marines. The neighborhood kind of watched out for him. We'd give him food, clothes. One day Eric just wasn't there. When he showed up a week later, he had a baby with him.
Brian's hands flexed into fists, relaxed, flexed into fists.
Are you telling me that Eric, the homeless vet, is my father?
Mike shook his head.
He wasn't your father. Your mother didn't think so anyway. That bitch wasn't my mother.
Mike grabbed and threw the beer bottle in one snap motion, a line drive of tumbling brown glass. Brian stepped aside. The bottle smashed against Pookie's driver's side window in an explosion of glass and beer. Mike Clouser stood up. He didn't look sad anymore.
Boy, he said in a low voice, you're my son, but she was my wife. You blaspheme her name again, and I'm going to string your ass out all over this street.
Brian felt his father's neck in his hands before he even realized he'd rushed in. Mike's eyes went wide with shock. Brian pulled him close and screamed in his face,
you threaten me again, and I'll kill you!
He felt Mike's pulse hammering against his fingers. Just a squeeze. What the hell was he doing? Brian released his grip, then took four slow steps back. Mike rubbed his throat with his free hand. He looked at Brian more with confusion than fear.
You've always been so calm, Mike said. You've never yelled at me before.
Hadn't yelled, and certainly had never put his hands on his father in anger. The intensity, these highs and lows, all of it was new. He'd had emotions before, of course he had, but nothing this pure, this overwhelming. What was happening to him?
Just finish your story, old man.
Mike stopped rubbing his throat. He sat down heavily, opened another bottle, and took a long drink.
We didn't know what to do, he said. I mean, what could we do? Eric brought the baby to us. He said he had to give the baby to us because he knew we'd make good parents. We watched out for Eric because he was crazy and homeless. A baby in his hands? That was dangerous. So we took you from him, just to make sure Eric didn't do something bad. And you didn't call the cops? You had an infant, probably kidnapped, and you didn't try to find the parents?
Mike sniffed, slid a hand across his nose. He sniffed again.
We thought we'd try and figure out where you came from, talk to Eric and get some information before we had to call the cops. For God's sake, Brian. Eric went crazy killing for our country, watching his buddies die all around him. We had to at least try and help him out of a jam.
Brian breathed slowly. He fought to control the heartbreak and rage swirling inside. This was the man he'd looked up to his entire life. A man who would take another's child.
I belonged to someone else, Brian said. Are you actually going to look me in the eye and say you did it to save some insane homeless guy from a well-deserved felony rap? What, were you hoping he'd bring another so you'd have a matched set? It wasn't like that, Mike said quickly. Eric was terrified, Brian. I've never seen anyone that scared. He said he had to find the baby a safe, loving home, or he'd get into a lot of trouble. He knew your mother couldn't have kids, so he brought you to us.
This just kept getting better.
Eric, the homeless guy, knew you guys couldn't have children? Everyone in the neighborhood knew. That's what God had chosen for us. We didn't broadcast it, but when people asked if we were going to have kids, we told them we couldn't. We thought of adopting, sure, but hadn't really focused on it. When Eric brought you to us, we couldn't help but think that maybe it was a miracle.
Brian's throat pinched. Sadness roared up to swirl side by side with the anger. How could they have done this to him?
A miracle? Are you shitting me?
Mike tilted his head a little, an expression that said, "Come on, think about it and you'll see."
Two people are totally in love but can't have kids. Then a baby shows up on their doorstep? What more proof of a miracle do you need?
Brian's words came out as a cracked yell.
How about making Mom able to have kids in the first place? Isn't that a more logical miracle than sending a homeless man with a kidnapped baby? I don't question the Lord's ways. That doesn't make you pious, that makes you stupid. What happened then? You just walked out and told everyone you'd suddenly had an immaculate conception and delivery?
Mike again looked to the ground.
We kept it very quiet. The night Eric dropped you off, I tried to talk to him, but he just kept babbling about what they would do to him if he failed. And who were they? He wouldn't say. The next night I tracked him down.
Mike paused. He took a sip of his beer.
Eric was dead, Brian. I think he OD'd on something. We didn't know what to do about you. Your mother and I read the papers, watched the news, waited for any story about a kidnapped baby. There was nothing.
This was the man who raised him. A liar. A coward who only thought of himself.
And still you didn't go to the cops. The kidnapper was dead. Someone had lost their goddamn child. And you didn't do anything?
Mike looked away.
After the second day, your mother and I were already so in love with you, we would have risked everything to keep you. If we'd known who the parents were, that would have been different. But there was no news at all. We told everyone we knew that your mother was already 4 months pregnant. I sent her away to a cabin in Yosemite. We told everyone she was staying at your grandmother's until the baby came.
Brian wanted to remind Mike that the women he was talking about were neither his mother nor his grandmother, but he kept quiet. Mike drained the beer in one long pull, then set it down with a glass-on-brick clink.
"Your mother came home with a baby. Simple as that. The neighbors bought it, hook, line, and sinker. Everyone commented on how big you were for a newborn. We just laughed and said you were going to play for the Niners someday and make us rich."
Mike opened another beer. He tossed the cap away. Because of this man, Brian would probably never know who his real parents were. For the first time in his life, Brian felt tears welling up in his eyes. He blinked rapidly, tried to hold them back.
"What about my birth certificate?"
"Flash enough money around Chinatown, you'll find a doctor who'll play ball. Your birth certificate just says you were born in this house, not a hospital."
"You kept a kidnapped infant and you bribed a doctor. What upstanding citizens. What happened next?"
Mike shrugged again.
"That's it. We loved you.
You were the center of our lives. God delivered you to us, and we spent every day trying to show God that we were worthy."
Brian couldn't stop the tears anymore.
"Thou shalt not lie. You ever hear of that one?"
The pain returned to Mike's eyes. His body sagged. He had never looked so old.
"We knew it was wrong," he said.
"After a little while, we were able to just block it out. We didn't think about it. You were our son."
Mike Clouser had been a rock, unflappable, reliable, always looking for the positive in all things. Now he seemed defeated, deflated perhaps, as if someone had stabbed him in the back and let his soul drain away. Brian felt torn in two directions. Part of him hated this man with every fiber of his being, while the other half saw Mike's pain, remembered all the love given during a wonderful childhood. He wanted to hit him. He also wanted to hug him. But he would never do that. Never again.
"You're not my father," Brian said. "You never were. Don't visit. Don't call. You're dead to me."
Mike's head dropped. His big body shook a little bit as he started to cry. Brian wiped his own tears as he turned away. The Buick smelled like beer. He got in and drove away. Fuck Mike Clouser. The man could burn in hell for all Brian cared. Mike didn't have the answers Brian needed. There was one place left that Brian might be able to get those answers. But not right now. Not today. He'd had enough. He just had enough.
Chapter 9. A Hospital Visit.
Chief Amy Zhao stared down at Jebediah Erickson. He looked so much older than the last time she'd seen him. Of course, that had been 26 years ago, when he'd left the asylum. The asylum that she'd sent him to. Amy had once been a snot-nosed rookie who knew better than the older cops. She and Rich had put the pieces together, connecting the symbols to the silver arrowheads, tracking down Alder Jessup, quietly building a case against Jebediah Erickson, even as her superiors tried to shut her up, tried to get her to back off. They'd even promoted her to inspector as a form of hush money. She'd taken the promotion, but hadn't stopped. At the time, she thought it poetic justice that she used her new power to further her efforts. She'd found the right judge to hear her case. She'd lined up the right person in the DA's office. Back then, Erickson hadn't been some old man in a hospital bed, bandaged, loaded with tubes leading into his nose, his arm. Back then, he'd been death personified. Just looking into those remorseless eyes had made her cross herself. Now he just seemed old. Scars covered his arms, his neck, his chest. Nasty scars, too. Long, curving things that must have required hundreds of stitches. This man was a warrior. The scars told the story of his battles.
"God damn it, Brian," she said. "You don't know what you've done."
She should have fired Brian and Pookie sooner. Pookie couldn't let something like this go. The Blake Johansson situation had proved that. If Pookie smelled crooked cops, he went after them. Maybe she should have switched him to internal affairs years ago. If she had told Pookie and Brian the truth about Erickson, about the monsters, would those guys have pursued the case anyway? Based on their track records, she'd assumed they would have done exactly that. And how could she hold it against them? They had done exactly the same thing she had done. When her efforts put Erickson in the loony bin, how many people had died from her stubbornness? More important, how many people would die now because of Brian's? This wasn't the first time Erickson had been out of commission. He'd been injured twice before that she knew of, but both times he'd left the hospital the very next day. This time, however, he didn't look like he was going anywhere. Was he just old, or was there something else? Hopefully he would recover soon, before Marie's children realized that they could once again kill at will. Chapter 10. Murder was the case. Sleeping until noon had a way of making anything more palatable. So Brian Clouser was a fleshy-headed mutant. So what? He was still Pookie's best friend. He had saved Pookie's life. Getting all worked up about this wasn't going to fix anything. Pookie would find a way to get his boy through this. Hell, it wasn't like Brian was a Yankees fan or anything really unforgivable. Emma danced around his feet. Pookie was supposed to just give one treat at a time, but he grabbed a big handful and dropped them on the kitchen floor. Life is short. Treats are good. He poured a cup of coffee from Robin's coffee maker. Nice machine. Everything the girl had was nice. Medical examiners, it seemed, earned a bit more income than homicide inspectors. He heard footsteps behind him, then a woman's voice.
Did you make coffee?
He turned with mug in hand. A sleepy-faced, yawning Robin shuffled into the dining room. She wore only a black T-shirt that was too big for her, one of Brian's most likely. She sat at the table. Pookie poured a mug for her, then sat as well. She took a sip.
I made a bunch of calls after you turned in. Then I ran out of steam. My friend Dana just called from the hospital, woke me up. Erickson is stabilized.
He's better?
Not even close, she said. He's still in intensive care. He hasn't woken up yet.
A knife in the belly was worse than a bullet in the shoulder, but Brian's wound had healed up within hours.
Erickson has the Zed. Why hasn't he healed?
Beats me,
Robin said.
All I have is a hypothesis. I don't know anything about these people. You heard from Brian?
Pookie hadn't, but he had received a voicemail from Brian's dad. Poor Mike was a mess. Maybe that was the price you paid for lying to your child your whole life, but Pookie wasn't about to judge.
No word from Bri-Bri yet, Pookie said. I think he's okay, so don't worry.
She crossed her arms and slowly rubbed her own shoulders.
He's not okay. Pookie, please just tell me what's really going on.
She was hurting bad for Brian. She wanted to share Brian's pain, help him through anything, but it wasn't Pookie's place to tell her the truth. If Brian didn't want her to know, that was his choice, and Pookie had to back up.
Oh, Bob, but you know what? As you've pointed out repeatedly, you're not his girlfriend anymore. It's none of your business.
She laughed at him.
Right. Now you're going to pretend he doesn't belong with me. You spent 6 months trying to get us back together.
She leaned forward and put her hand on his wrist.
Pookie, I made a mistake pushing Brian away. I love him. I also know him. Maybe not as well as you do, but I know him, and I think he's real close to doing something bad. If you don't let me help, and something happens to him, you won't be able to live with yourself.
He didn't have a one-liner this time. She was right, but that didn't change anything. Telling Robin, or anyone else, was Brian's decision alone.
I can't,
Pookie said. Her eyes narrowed. He had a sudden feeling that she was looking right into his brain with that magic chick power that women have. She turned and looked at the rap scan machine sitting on the table. Her eyes widened. She covered her mouth.
Oh, my God! That second sample! It was from Brian!
What had he said? Was it that obvious? Or had he done something to tip her off? He had to cover, and cover fast.
Ah, come on now, why would you say that?
She turned angry eyes on him.
That's why he went to see Mike. The second sample was XYZ, so Mike can't be his real father.
Robin, the second sample wasn't Brian's, it was...
She slapped the table.
Stop it! We both know I'm right, so stop insulting my intelligence.
She pointed her finger in his face.
Don't you lie to me one more minute, you understand me?
Pookie leaned back. He nodded.
Okay. You're right.
The anger broke. Tears welled up in her eyes. Oh, Jesus, now he had to deal with a crying woman?
Take it easy, we'll figure something out. Brian is my boy, that's not going to change.
This isn't about being boys, she said. I can't imagine what he's going through. Oh, my God, he went to confront Mike, and you let him go by himself?
Huh? When she said it like that, it did sound kind of stupid. She wiped her eyes with the backs of her hands.
I have to find him, he's all alone.
If he's alone, it's because that's what he wants.
She stood.
This isn't about what he wants, it's about what he needs. You should have known that.
As soon as she said it, he knew she was right. That Detroit-sized nuke had dropped in Brian's life, and Pookie had thought the man could handle it solo.
He's still the Brian we know, Pookie said. He won't do anything stupid.
She wiped her eyes again as she let out another derisive laugh.
You mean he won't do anything stupid, like go into the house of a killer without a warrant or backup?
Pookie's eyebrows rose.
Touché, Bobobin. Touché.
His cell chimed the theme from The Simpsons. Robin walked to her bedroom. Emma padded along behind her. Pookie knew she was going to get dressed, then try to find Brian. There was no point trying to stop her. So instead, Pookie answered his phone.
Black Mr. Burns, my day is already about as tasty as a St. Bernard turd rolled in rancid salmon poon. Whatever you have to tell me now is going to make my emotional boo-boos all better, right?
Only if you like your salmon poon turd served with a side of tainted clams,
John said.
I finished that murder rate analysis.
Pookie sighed.
Ah, screw it. Go ahead.
First, some perspective. San Francisco's population peaked in the 1950s at 775,000. Right now, it's about 767,000. Not much variation in the past 50 years. So the population is a constant against which we can evaluate murders on a basic one-to-one, year-to-year basis.
Do you always talk like the band nerd that played the French horn?
What?
For example, when you fuck, do you say shit like, I'm going to insert my penis now, then move it back and forth in a rapid motion until one or both of us achieve an orgasm?
Yes, but only when I'm banging your mom.
For the second time that afternoon, Pookie's eyebrows rose in respect.
Point taken, Mr. Burns. Continue.
The highest murder rate in recent memory was 1993, with 133 murders. Things have been down lately. We haven't had over 100 since 1995. 27 years ago, however, there were 241 murders. That's the highest the city has ever officially recorded. What that doesn't take into account is the fact that in that same year, from January to June, there were 187 murders for an average of 31 a month. In July, it dropped to 19. After that, the murders dropped off to 7 a month, which is about the normal murder rate. Now, guess when Jebediah Erickson was released from detention in the California medical facility?
The coffee felt funny in Pookie's stomach. He felt like he was going to throw up. I don't want to guess.
I'll tell you anyway. He got out that same July. Erickson gets locked in the loony bin, and a few months later the murder rate skyrockets. He gets out, things almost immediately come back down to normal.
Yes, he was definitely going to puke. Vigilantism was one thing, but to have that kind of impact on a murder rate?
There's more,
John said.
The crime spike wasn't just for homicides. Missing persons cases tripled in the same time frame, and serial killings were up 500%. Records indicate the Bay Area may have had 7 serial killers in action at the same time. That shit never got released to the press, because Mayor Moscone sat on it like an ugly fat girl riding a willing drunk.
See, when you talk like that, it makes all this death and despair so much more fun.
I'm doing my best to make it more palatable.
The jokes were automatic for Pookie, but he felt none of the humor.
You said the murder rate didn't spike when Erickson first went in.
It didn't. Things were normal for several months, then slowly ramped up to the levels I told you about.
Pookie thought of a stuffed little girl holding a fork and a knife. Erickson probably hadn't killed her on a whim. Would people like that girl run wild if Erickson was out? More important, were there more creatures out there like the four-eyed bear thing? Chief Zhao's words rang through his head. She'd asked for his trust. She'd told him there was more going on than he could know. If only she'd just come out and explain this. But even then, would Pookie have gone along with it? Zhao had known he and Brian might push too far, possibly get Erickson committed again, leave the city open to mass murder. But they hadn't put him away. Instead, they'd put him in the ICU.
One more thing,
John said.
I have a hypothesis about Erickson and why the killings didn't go up right away.
Pookie made a mental note to write that down. Two friends using the word hypothesis in the same day. Maybe he was moving up in the world. Hit me, B&B.
Do you know what a Keystone Predator is?
Is it a Pennsylvania pedophile?
No, but that was clever,
John said.
It's a predator that keeps a population in check. Like hawks that hunt lemmings, or sea stars that feed on sea urchins that would eat the kelp roots and therefore kill the kelp, throwing the whole ecosystem into crisis and...
Get to the point, bro.
Sorry,
John said.
A keystone predator keeps a prey population in check. Remove that predator. You get a population explosion of the prey species. Let's say Marie's children were responsible for that murder spike. Maybe Erickson is their keystone predator. Take him out, the killers go crazy. Put him back in the ecosystem, he kills them or sends them back into hiding, maybe both. Think about the things you said you saw in Erickson's basement.
The bear thing, the blue bug, the shark-mouthed man. Had those once been lurking around the city, killing people?
You think that 70-year-old Jebediah Erickson is the keystone predator of goddamn monsters?
Yeah,
John said.
We fucked up, Pooks. If Erickson doesn't get out of that hospital, things could get real bad.
Could get bad. Like they weren't bad enough already.
John, thanks. It's a shitty picture, but now we know.
Computers are my business, and business is good.
Not just that, Pookie said. You really stepped up last night. If you hadn't come out, Erickson would have come in after us. It could have been Brian in the hospital, or in the morgue. I'm proud of you, man.
John was silent for a few minutes.
Thanks,
he said finally.
You got no idea what that means to me coming from you.
Pookie heard the apartment's front door open and slam shut. Emma came treading into the kitchen. Ears up, she stared at him with a face that said, "It's just you and me, kid."
Burns, I gotta go. Do me a favor and call the Terminator. He won't answer, so just data dump all that goodness in his voicemail. If you reach him, though, call me.
Will do.
Pookie hung up. He walked to the kitchen and grabbed the half-empty box of dog treats. He was about to drop another handful. but instead just upended the box. Emma started eating them like they might suddenly grow legs and run away. Pookie headed out of the apartment to find his partner. Chapter 11. The Hidey Hole. Rex paced. There wasn't much space to do even that. It only took 10 steps to cross the room. A damp cold put a moisture sheen on the stone walls, making them reflect the candles that lit the room. The place looked like it had started out as a crack in the rock, then had been chipped away at to make room for a bed, a bookshelf, a table, and a chair. A skull sat on the floor in a corner. A human skull. Maybe someone had put it there to see if it scared him. It didn't. There were gouges in the skull's face bones, like someone had scraped at them with their teeth. Moldy books sat on the shelves. To pass the time, he tried to read one called On the Road, but he'd only made it 5 pages before the spine split, and page 6 crumbled when he tried to turn it. He didn't want to read anyway. There were no clocks, yet somehow he knew the sun had already set. He could feel it. His whole life he had felt tired and sluggish during the day, had trouble sleeping at night. He'd always felt exhausted at school, felt slow, like the world was slipping by him in a way he couldn't understand. Well, now he knew why. The day was made for sleeping. Night was the time to hunt. There was a word for creatures that lived at night and slept during the day. Nocturnal. Rex paced. Sly would be back soon, and he would take Rex home. Chapter 12. Alex. The metallic sound rattled through the white room. Aggie and the Chinaman ran to the wall, put their backs to it, pressed their collars to the flanges as the chains started to rattle and draw tight. The boy with no tongue was lying flat on his back.
"Get up, boy! Get to the wall or that chain's gonna yank you!"
The boy's eyes opened. He looked at Aggie with an empty stare. Aggie had seen that look on the streets many times, the look of someone who's given up. The chain snapped taut, yanking the boy by his neck. That got his attention. His eyes scrunched tight with pain as hands flew to the collar. He slid along on his back, spitting up fresh blood. The chain pulled the boy up the wall until his collar clanged against the flange. He coughed and stared out, wide-eyed and confused. The white gate opened. 7 white-robed, masked men came in. Wolfman, Darth Vader, Tigerface, Frankenstein, Dracula, Jason Voorhees. And was that the Green Power Ranger? 7 of them. And this time, 2 dragging sticks. Aggie's breath lodged in his lungs, stayed there like a rock that kept him from inhaling or exhaling. Who had the masked men come for this time? Wolfman, Tigerface, and Frankenstein headed straight for the Chinaman, who screamed in terror. The other 4 moved to the big boy. He screeched a mewling, sad sound that tried and failed to form words. Aggie's body sagged in relief. A guilty feeling of knowing joy at someone else's demise once again overwhelmed him, filled him with bottomless self-hate, but there was nothing he could do to help either of them. The white-robed men closed in on the boy. He kicked out, or tried to, but he slipped and fell, yanking the collar hard against his neck and chin. Before he could get his feet under him, the monster masks were on him, black-gloved hands reaching in, grabbing, hitting, pulling, holding. The Chinaman tried to fight, but he wasn't like that scrappy Mexican. The masked man easily overpowered him. Frankenstein reached in with his stick and hooked the Chinaman's collar. He screamed and cried as they dragged him out of the cell. Aggie looked back at the boy. Darth Vader hooked the boy's collar. The robed men wasted no time pulling him toward the door. The boy kicked. He screamed guttural sounds. Splatters and streams of blood bubbled out with each desperate breath, the red marking his path along the white floor. They took him out of the white cell, but this time the door didn't close. Aggie stared, waiting, wondering. Hillary walked through. No cart this time, no sandwiches. She walked right up to Aggie. She leaned in close. He forced himself not to flinch away, not that there was anywhere he could go. She was his only hope. She sniffed him. She smiled, showing her missing teeth.
You are better.
Aggie shook his head so violently it rattled the chain in his flange. If he was better, they would take him away like the others.
I'm still real sick. I need my medicine.
Hillary laughed, a light sound that anywhere else in the world would have sounded delightful.
You understand,
she said.
You are smarter than most of those we bring down here.
Aggie kept shaking his head. She reached out a wrinkled hand and grabbed his jaw, holding him still. He started to talk, but she put a finger on his lips.
Shh,
she said.
Now I show you what happens if you don't help me. Now we go and see Mommy.
Chapter 13. Loneliness. Robin sat on her couch, Emma's blocky head in her lap, a half-empty glass of wine in her hand. No lights. Sometimes you just have to sit in the dark. Outside her apartment window, the breeze rippled a tree, making shadows of the branches and leaves weave curving patterns against her linen curtains. A day's worth of searching for Brian had taught her that she didn't know the first thing about finding someone who didn't want to be found. She'd checked his apartment, the Hall of Justice, the Bigfoot Lodge. No Brian. She'd even walked around Rex Dobrovolchuk's house and visited the spot where Jay Pilar had died. Nothing in those places either. She left at least 10 messages. He hadn't called back, not even when she called to let him know that Erickson had just been downgraded from critical to stable condition. How much more messed up could things be? Her poor Brian. What must he be feeling right now? How would she feel if she were the one with that mutation? And as if that weren't enough, Brian knew the family he loved so much wasn't his real family at all. She took another sip of wine. The little bit of light filtering through the curtains reflected off Emma's inner eyes, making them flash a luminescent green. When Robin was upset, Emma always knew and tried to get close. The dog let out a little whimper.
I'm fine, sweetie,
Robin said.
It is what it is.
And what was it? It was going through the rest of her days without the only man she wanted. All the wine in the world couldn't chase that away. It was living half of a life. A knock on the apartment door made Emma's head snap in that direction. The dog scrambled up, inadvertently digging her claws into Robin's thigh as she pushed off hard and ran for the entryway. Robin winced, stood up, and set the wine glass down on the end table. She followed Emma to the door. The dog had her nose down at the base of the door. Her oversized tail swished so madly, her rear end almost toppled her over. But she only acted like that when... Robin held her breath as she opened the door. Emma shot into the hall and started circling Brian's legs, throwing her body against him. He reached down and picked her up in his familiar way. Her rear legs dangled limply. Her tail pounded against his leg and her pink tongue flicked madly at his face.
Easy, Boo, he said.
He set Emma down, then turned his green eyes on Robin.
Hey,
he said. He looked like he hadn't slept in days. He looked hopeless.
Hey,
she said. He started to talk, then stopped. He looked away.
I didn't know where else to go.
She stood aside and held the door open. Brian walked in, Emma at his heels. He seemed to be in a daze. He walked into the dark living room and sat on her couch. She sat near him, but not right next to him. Emma wasn't as cautious. The black and white dog flopped down on his feet and looked up at him lovingly, her tail thumping a regular pattern on the throw rug. Robin watched him for a moment, then spoke.
I looked for you today,
she said.
I couldn't find you.
Oh. I was sleeping.
Where?
Pookie's car, he said. I think. I just kind of wandered.
His beard had grown so frizzy. It reminded her she still had his beard trimmer in the bathroom. She'd always meant to get rid of it, but found reasons not to. She wanted to touch that beard, gently stroke it and take his pain away.
I was having some wine. Would you like a glass?
He stared out into the room, into nothing.
Got anything stronger?
Your scotch supply is still here. Talisker on the rocks?
He nodded in a way that said he'd have taken anything she had. She made him his drink, flashing back to the time they'd lived together when she had loved making him drinks. They'd been equals in most areas of life, but she couldn't help the fact that she liked to wait on him a little. Moments later, she handed him the glass. Ice cubes rattled as he took it. He liked as much ice as the glass would hold. He drained it in one pull and handed it back to her.
Want another?
He nodded. Emma's tail kept up its steady rhythm. Robin refilled his glass, then sat down next to him. She picked up his hand, gently pressed the glass into it.
Robin, what am I going to do?
I don't know,
she said.
It's a bit of an unusual situation, to say the least.
He nodded, took a small sip. She picked up her wine glass. They sat in the dark, in silence, together. This time she waited until he spoke first.
What am I?
You're Brian Clauser.
No, I'm not. That part of my life is a lie.
She wasn't going to argue with him about that one. Maybe she could talk to his father later, see if there was anything she could do. But for now, she wasn't about to feed Brian platitudes.
You're a cop,
she said.
Yes, I know you're fired, but that doesn't change the fact that you're a man who's dedicated his life to serving the greater good.
He took another sip.
I used to think that was why I did it, but now I'm not so sure.
What do you mean?
He finally turned to look at her. The room's shadows hit his face, took the light out of his green eyes.
I think I drifted into the job because of what I really am. I think I became a cop because I like to hunt.
Robin wondered if she looked afraid, because suddenly she was. Brian had said, because I like to hunt, but what he meant was, because I like to hunt people. He took another sip.
Some cops kill a guy, and it messes them up so bad they quit the force. I've killed 5 men. 5. All in the line of duty, all righteous shoots, okay, but still. I don't feel bad about any of them.
He turned away again, looking off into nothingness. This new Brian, the one with the emotions turned full on, he was a frightening man. If she didn't already know him and met him in a dark alley, she'd run the other way. But she did know him. There was so much pain in his face. She wanted to take him into her arms, pull his head to her chest, and slowly stroke his hair.
Brian, there's a difference between being a murderer and being a protector. Cops carry guns for a reason.
He turned to face her again.
But shouldn't I feel something? Some kind of remorse or guilt, or whatever the fuck the psychologist kept asking me after every time I put someone down.
What do you want me to say? If you hadn't done what you'd done, Pookie would be dead. John would be dead, and you'd be dead. You saved lives. It's not like you have an urge to go out and eat babies.
He said nothing.
Because if you want to eat babies, Brian, I'm going to have to go ahead and ask you to put down the scotch.
He kept staring. Then she saw the corners of his mouth turn up just a bit. He was fighting a smile. She waited, knowing him well enough to know exactly what would happen next. His mouth trembled once, twice. Then he lost his battle with a laugh. He shook his head.
You have to be kidding me. Jokes? Now?
She shrugged.
Maybe I've been hanging out with Pookie too much.
Brian's smile faded. The sadness returned to his eyes, and in that moment her soul felt like it would splinter and blow away on the wind. She turned her back to him, then slid onto his lap. He started to react, but before he could say anything, she reached one hand up to the back of his head and used his rigidity to pull herself in for